this colloquium is being organized as a part of DBS annual talks. Firstly, I would like to thank the department and also Mahindra and also Tomna for making this happen. Again, on behalf of the institute and also the ASCET colloquium, I would like to invite I was told that you people had one of the last event of your annual talks is art and science some competition. So luckily this entry probably was not there. So hands down the person who created would have got the first prize without any competition. So more of such and very interesting things to know. Today we have the speaker here, and without taking more of our time, I request Mahindra to formally introduce today's speaker.
He is a faculty at ISET Trivandrum. And before he moved to ISET Trivandrum, he did his PhD on butterflies and butterfly diversification in from the University of Stockholm. And then he moved to Cambridge University, where he continued working on butterflies and butterfly diversification. And his current research interests are in evolution, in the context of how plants and animals have diversified. In that particular context, he's looking at animal color patterns. And I'm sure many of you understand why colors and color patterns are important in animals. It influences many aspects of animal lives, like mate choice, reproduction, behavior. And it will be really interesting to hear Ulla's talk.
So, thanks Mahindra, and thanks to DBS for inviting me. So, in fact, you gave a nice prelude to my talk. You talked about mate choice. It's not all? You talk about mate choice, how animals use colors for mate choice. That is something I will not talk about. But a lot of animal colors that we see, especially these bright and conspicuous colors, they are for mate choice. So I'll be talking about how these lizards seem to use these color patterns against predation. So, firstly, I should mention almost all the work I'll be talking about is done by my PhD student Gopal, which is why I think I had to put his name here. And secondly, you'll notice I've written conspicuousness within quotes. The reason is, these colors, they look conspicuous to us, but we really don't know what's happening in terms of predator vision. For example, if you had hypothetically the rock being completely blue, this one, this tail would be cryptic. Or if you had a rock which had these kind of stripy patterns, in some orientation it would be cryptic, right? So keep this in mind. But generally speaking, when we look at these beautiful colors, these striped patterns and so on, they do look bright, they are striking, they are conspicuous, very generally speaking. But bear in mind that conspicuousness is always in relation to the background. So I'll be talking about these colorful tails and these striping patterns, stripes. Right. So if you think of natural selection, one of the strongest selective forces in nature is predation. So all of them, almost all animals face predation. Plants, of course, they face pressure from their herbivores. So but this talk will be mainly about animals. So predation is a very strong selective agent in nature. And this has led to some spectacular adaptations in nature. So this poison arrow frog here has some toxic secretions on its skin. It's using these colors to advertise its toxicity. This one here looks like a snake, but it's in fact a caterpillar of a moth. So this is an example of what is called as Batesian mimicry, for those of you who are interested. So this, by looking like a snake, like a pit viper, it quite likely avoids being eaten by birds and so on. This one here you have dried leaves, and this one here is a lizard. So you can see the tail, the body, and the head. So this is an example of what is called as masquerade. So masquerade, so it's masquerading as a dried leaf. So it's one example of one type of crypsis. Then we have these beautiful conspicuous features called eye spots on this butterfly. It's there in many other butterflies. And we have shown in our lab, this was also part of some work I did during my PhD, we've shown that these eye spots, they make predators like birds hesitate before they attack. So the idea is that these eye spots, they resemble eyes of predators, own predators. So for example, if a little bird is trying to attack this butterfly, it looks at these eye spots and the decisions are made in a split second. So it might suddenly think that its own predator, a larger bird or a snake, has come into picture and might hesitate. So we've done experiments and we've shown that this is in fact the case. So there are some fantastic adaptations in nature. Perhaps the most common is crypsis. Crypsis through background matching. So I'm sure if you spend enough time, you will see, of course, you will see a tree, and on the tree you'll see a lizard as well, which is hiding right here. Right? So it's right here. It's quite big, in fact. So this is an example of crypsis through background matching. So in this particular case, the animal's color patterns, they have sampled elements from its background. So that's how it works. So crypsis through background matching is extremely common. It's one of the most widespread adaptations in nature. So let's say this is a background and you have a cryptic prey. What happens when the prey moves? So when it's still, it's quite cryptic, very cryptic. But when the animal moves, it's not as cryptic. Predators can pick it up. Okay? So crypsis, especially crypsis by background matching, is given away by movement. And animals, of course, they can't sit still all the time. They can't all be nocturnal. So they have to move around, and they will be seen by predators. And there are other constraints as well. So they cannot simply pick up elements from the background and be cryptic. There might be sexual selection. Females might choose males based on some color patterns, some colorful color patterns, and so on. So they can't afford to be cryptic all the time, cryptic with respect to that particular background. And it also depends on the predator vision and so on. For now, let's keep those aside. So a lot of work has been done in relation to crypsis. This is just one type of crypsis. There are various other kinds of crypsis, and people have been studying crypsis and so on for very long. But there's not been so much attention towards how animals may use these conspicuous or striking colors against predators, right? So this is what I'll be talking about. Gopal, my student, is a very avid herpetologist. He loves snakes and reptiles. So he came up with some ideas, and eventually, after a lot of discussion, they evolved into the work that I'm going to present now. So a lot of lizards, there are about 6,000 lizard species. It depends, because snakes are also derived lizards, technically. So if you look at it in terms of purely from a biological perspective, if you look at the evolutionary history and so on, snakes belong to lizards, so lizards would be about 9,000 to 10,000 species, right? So there are a lot of lizards which have stripes on their bodies, on their head and the torso, and they also have very bright or very colorful tails. So here's one anti-predatory strategy, which is again fairly common. So many animals have these structures which are found on less important parts of the body. For example, this butterfly here has these smaller eye spots which are present along the wing margin. And these are quite conspicuous. And the idea is that they distract the predator, and when a bird is trying to attack bird, or it could be a lizard which is trying to attack this butterfly, is distracted by these eye spots. And if you'll notice, the real head and the thorax and so on, they're quite dull. They merge with the other parts of the wing, so they're not very conspicuous, whereas these eye spots are quite conspicuous. So the idea is that they will deflect attacks towards themselves. And a butterfly can escape, perhaps with a torn wing, which is not really bad, because the butterfly can still survive, lay eggs, mate, and so on, right? So deflection, it's supposed to be there in fish, although there are no experiments in fish which support this idea. There are a lot of fishes which have these eye spots on their fins and so on. Whereas in butterflies, there's some good evidence now that under certain conditions, for example, in this experiment, they found that under certain conditions, all the attacks by birds are directed towards the eye spots. In the case of lizards, bird attacks, when we consider bird attacks, and for the purpose of this talk, let's assume that birds are the main predator community on these lizards, which is quite likely true in most cases. Right. So the birds seem to know where to attack. So they always go for they almost always go for the head. So here, if you look at the surface area or the length covered by the head, trunk, tail, and limbs, and so on. So if the attacks were random, then you'd expect more attacks. So the expected is the green. You'd expect fewer attacks to the head, more here, and so on. But the data suggests that you get more attacks to the head. So this is also it depends on the lizard. Not all lizards can turn behind and bite. It depends where they're holding it. But generally, It makes intuitive sense. It's not surprising at all. This is just an observation. I'm just highlighting the point that birds seem to know where to attack. Okay? It'll make even more intuitive sense when we consider that many lizards can shed their tail. It's called tail autotomy. Okay? So over time, birds who attack the tail, they're going to get a smaller food packet. So they probably will learn to attack the head instead. Okay? Right. For the lizard, it makes sense to deflect attacks towards the tail, especially when it has the ability to shed the tail and regenerate the tail. Right? So the idea was that lizards have these bright tails to deflect attacks. And there was one experiment which suggested just that. So they placed clay models, brown body and blue tails, compared attacks. So if you place these clay models outside, you can get birds to attack. Birds, you know, they can make mistakes, so they do attack. So you can look at the peck marks and so on. And they compared attack rates on this one with completely brown clay models. So here are the attacks towards the tail tip and the mid of the tail. So when they have blue tails, a lot of attacks are directed towards the tail. Whereas for the brown one, this is all these brown bars are for the completely brown models. Most of the attacks are directed towards the head. So this data set quite strongly suggests that colorful tails can deflect predatory attacks.
What happens to the overall attack frequency?
Overall attack frequency. You're right, that's an important point. So by virtue of having colorful tails, they're probably more conspicuous overall, and they might attract more attacks overall, right? There's always a trade-off having these conspicuous deflective structures, right? You can see a small difference here. So there's always a trade-off. But overall, having colorful tails wins, given this trade-off. That's the assumption. And that's what most data sets suggest, right?
It is
so birds probably see blue better. So there are some models and so on. So generally in lizards, when you have bright tails, it's either red or blue. It's just two. Nobody really knows exactly why. I'll touch a little bit upon that when I come to some of our results. Right, so we got interested in stripes. Why stripes? I mean, colorful tails, in a way we can explain them, but why stripes? So there was this naturalist, Abbot Thayer, a very smart guy. He came up with a lot of hypotheses, some of which are still being tested, one of which we have tested here. So he suggested that certain kinds of patterns, for example, stripes, which are composed of contrasting elements. So these kinds of patterns, you can have stripes, or he also suggested zigzags and so on. So he suggested that they could confuse predators about the direction of motion. When the prey is moving around, the predator may be confused about the direction of motion, or they may not be able to judge the speed of motion. Okay? So he suggested that by having these kinds of what he called dazzle patterns, prey can benefit when they are moving around. And this principle, in a way, has also been used in ships and so on in the Second World War. Nowadays it doesn't work. They have more fancy equipment which can detect ships and so on. But many ships were painted with these motion dazzle patterns. We don't really know if they worked, but they tried. So there's some data which suggests that when patterns with different kinds of dazzle-like markings, when they're moving around, you can compare attack rates. So if this is a touchscreen experiment, you can get humans to attack these moving prey, and you can compare attack rates and so on. And there's some preliminary data which suggests that this could be the case, right? So we set about looking at this in more detail. So our hypothesis was this. When birds attempt to attack the head or the body, they might miss the body and instead attack the tail. So these kinds of experiments are very difficult to do with real prey and real predators. For example, the eye spot, the butterfly eye spots, we've worked with chicken and other birds in the lab. They're quite easy to work with. But to get birds to attack moving prey under lab conditions, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to manipulate this prey and so on. So what we did was we designed a computer game. So Gopal wrote a little game, so in which there were these rectangular prey which were moving around on the screen, and humans were recruited as predators who would go and attack these guys. And then we would look at where the attacks were directed, how many attacks were successful, and so on. And we can also manipulate the prey in the way we want to look at, you know, small differences in how it affects attack rates and so on. So each person was presented two models on a computer with a screen, a screen which had a touch screen, and they were asked to attack the anterior half. So this is the direction of motion. They were asked to attack the front, the anterior part. So in the first experiment, we compared prey which had stripes in the anterior plus a plain posterior. So this is mimicking a lizard with stripes in the anterior and a plainly colored tail. So we compared this to rectangular prey where we had the same proportion of white and black, but instead of stripes, we had random blotched patterns which were distributed across the body. And in nature, you do have lizards which have patterns distributed across their body. So in a sense, this is not completely alien. So this was a simple game. It was, in fact, an online thing. It works in the web browser and so on. So this is a prey which keeps moving around. One of the prey is randomly chosen. It appears, it keeps moving around for 1 minute, and people try to attack. So because we are in an undergrad institution, it's easy to get a lot of recruits. That's one nice thing. So our sample sizes tend to be quite good. So everything is automated. So we record the number of hits to the anterior, to the center, to the posterior, the total number of attempts. So everything is recorded. So this is what we found. So this is the proportion of successful attacks. So a successful attack would be something that's either on the anterior or on the center. An unsuccessful attack in this particular case would be something on the posterior, so the tail, so to say, right? So what we found is that for this prey type, the proportion of successful attacks was higher. So these ones, they seem to escape. So, okay, in all these slides, this side, the left side is the anterior.
So, in joining the brain with the version that has the blobs, is there something that would be?
There's nothing that, it's just a direction of motion, nothing else. There's just a direction of motion. Yeah. So, they're asked to hit the front, so to say. They were asked specifically to hit the anterior, and they were told that that would be successful. Anterior is whatever is moving, whatever is in the front. They were told specifically. Yes. Well, in this particular case, they didn't or they couldn't. I'll come to that. I'll come to that why they couldn't, why this difference. I'll come to that. Right. So, one can now argue, so maybe it's not, so here you have two differences. One is that there are blotched and striped patterns in the front, rather the blotched patterns are everywhere, whereas here the white ones are only in the front. So one can argue now, what happens if you switched the stripes to the posterior and had a plain front part, right? So this is what we did in the next experiment. So here, according to our hypothesis based on lizard coloration, we should not expect these guys to do better, right? So that's what we found. So when we switch, there's no difference in the number of, in the proportion of successful attacks. Okay. So now one can argue, maybe it's nothing to do with stripes. If you have any kind of patterns which are restricted only to the anterior, you still get attacks being deflected to the posterior, right? No, in all cases the stripes are always this way.
So what I was wondering, if you change the orientation, is because we are more sensitive towards like moving contrast gradient.
Right. So one could do that. So as I said, there are animals which have zigzags and so on. But one thing is, we wanted to mimic what we find in nature. The lizard which have stripes, they typically run. They typically run along the length of the body. So we wanted to mimic that.
That's what I was wondering, whether it got selected because the motion sensitivity of stripes is different particles
or so. Right. So I'll touch upon that. So as I mentioned, these motion dazzle patterns, they are thought to work either by affecting speed perception or direction perception. So what I think is that these ones work in disrupting speed perception, and when you have different angles and so on, they can also affect the direction. So we have some data which suggests, which talks about these kinds of stripes. Right. So here there's no difference, and then we wanted to see whether any kinds of patterns in the front, in the anterior. So in this case, what do you mean by response rate?
Okay.
Fine. Okay.
So
So one could look at, and what you're talking about is latency to attack. So one could, I guess, look at the data and see whether one of these had a increased latency to attack. That would matter. But in this particular case, it was very obvious, the touchscreen setup, people would just go peck, 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 peck. They would just keep on attacking. I don't think in this particular setup there was a difference. But in nature, it would make a difference, which we have not explicitly incorporated into our experiment. Okay? So that is related to, I think, somebody else has a conspicuousness. You know, having really bright colors, that itself might reduce the latency to attack in nature. Right? Having stripes, for example, the predator might be able to see it from a longer distance. Okay. Okay. So we compared these two, and now, according to our hypothesis, the prediction would be that these guys would perform better compared to these guys. And again, there are analogs in nature for these kinds of patterns where they have only patterns in the anterior and a plain tail. So that's what we found. We did find that the attack rates were higher when there were random patterns in the anterior compared to when there were stripes on the anterior. Right. So these three experiments, was there a question? No? So these three experiments fairly strongly suggest that there's something about stripes being in the anterior, in the front. Yeah. So, is there any difference between so between this and having these things spread all around? This was not part of this particular thing, but we have done those kinds of things, and there tends to be a difference, and that is probably related to the fact that, you know, there's this black thing and it's easier for them to aim, to attack and so on. But I mean, those results are there, but I didn't present them because they're not really relevant to this hypothesis. But generally, if you have something plain and something in the front, people, even though you tell them to attack the front, they tend to go towards the easier one, very generally speaking. I think that's what one of the audience members also pointed. Right. So now all I've talked about is the proportion of attacks. But if the total number of attacks here is much higher, then this is of no benefit, right? So, of course, we had to look at that. And thankfully for us, there was no difference in the total number of attacks here, either in experiment 1 or in experiment 3. So there was a small difference here in experiment 2, but that's not really relevant, okay? So the total number of attacks is the same, but the proportion of attacks to the front varies, okay, which is in line with our hypothesis. So, why? So, what is the mechanism behind this deflection towards the posterior? So, one could be that when something is moving around, having a plain tail is an easier target. It's easier to track, it's easier to process, it's easier to attack. Whereas something with stripes, if it's moving around, it may not be as easy to track, right? So Gopal has looked at some models of bird vision and so on, and he's done some stuff which suggests this is the case. But I'll talk about a second hypothesis. Stripes alter speed perception. So, if striped objects appear to move slower than they're actually moving, so if the striped thing is moving around and a bird is trying to attack, or a human in this case is trying to attack the anterior, if the human perceives that object to move slower, then the human is more likely to hit the tail, the posterior. Right? How do you test this? One way to do it is present a striped one and a randomly blotched one, and ask participants which one is moving faster. They can both be the same speed. But this introduces a lot of noise. We probably would need 1,000 or 2,000 people to actually find any difference, even if there is. So we adopted this procedure. This is used in psychophysics. So what we did was, we had two prey. So one is a striped one, the other is the randomly blotched one. So one of them was designated as the control. The other one was designated as the target. So the control always had exactly the same speed. The target, the other one, initially it started somewhere. It could be, the speed could be greater than the control, less than the control, or same as the control. It doesn't really matter. So one moves across the screen, the other one moves, they're randomly chosen. And the participant is asked which one moved faster. So in this particular case, so this is the control, if the participant says the target is moving slower, then in the next step, the speed of the target is increased. Again, in the next iteration, if the person says it's moving slower, it's increased. So you keep on increasing with each successive trial or each successive iteration until the point where the participant says, now this one is moving faster. When the participant says that, you switch. In the next one, you reduce the speed. Okay? You keep reducing until the participant says, now this is moving faster. Then you increase. So when the participant says this is moving slower. So this way you keep modifying trial after trial. And what happens is, in practice, it oscillates around some speed. Okay? And the speed here is the actual speed of the target where it is perceived to move as fast as the control. Okay? So in this particular case, the target, the perceived speed of the target is generally less. In other words, these whatever patterns you have on the target, they make the humans to perceive it to move slower, which is why we have to increase its actual speed for it to be perceived at par with the control. So if you had this graph stabilizing here, it means that this pattern is perceived to move faster, because of which you have to reduce the speed for it to be perceived this, as fast as the control, right? So according to our hypothesis, we would predict that the striped patterns, if they are perceived to move slower, because of which they end up hitting the tail, then they should stabilize somewhere here, or they should stabilize above, which is what we found. So the 17.5 is always the control, and the control, of course, depended on which side of which column we are looking at. So in this particular case, this one was the control, this one was the target, here is the other way around. So in both cases, we find that the one with stripes is perceived to move slower, okay? Because you have to increase the speed for it to be perceived to move at the same speed as this one. Okay? So this strongly suggests that when you have stripes on the anterior, they make the prey appear to move slower, because of which humans end up attacking the posterior. Yeah. So, as I said, there is some evidence, which I did not present, which does suggest that, you know, the orientation of these stripes and so on, these things are more difficult. Of course, these blotches, when this thing is moving like this, depending on the shape of the blotches, for example, if you had stripes going along like this, you know, they are still stripes, but that one would be easier to track because the contrast is perpendicular to the direction of motion. So in that sense, we would need to control that. We could look at it in more detail, yes. Right? Does that answer your question? Yeah? Yeah. Huh. In fact, that's another set of experiments a master student has been doing. He's been looking at various aspects of stripes, including direction, and we are looking at when the prey moves in a random erratic manner, when it just moves straight and so on. So that's another series of experiments that's going on. In our experiments, yes, our experiments suggest that the background really does not make a huge difference. Hmm? Yeah, in nature also, I would not expect background to have a huge role, because once they're moving, the effect of background kind of goes down. Hmm? But it can have for example, if you have a completely black background, then all you see is these little white things moving around. So then you can have some issues there. Okay. So in all these cases, what we did was the background, we used a 50% gray background, which is intermediate between black and white. Okay. So it's always balanced. So this is a study which is reported that in this skink, Isu Island skinked lizard. So in this species, when they're juveniles, they have both conspicuous tails and these stripes, but when they mature, they lose both. So the stripes fade out and the tail color also fades out. And in the same species, also in other species, in some populations where predation pressure is high, they tend to have both colorful tails and stripes, but when predation pressure is less, they tend to lose both. The same lizard, different population. Okay? So then we started thinking, you know, we think that bright colors redirect attacks to the tail. And our experiments strongly suggest that stripes also redirect attacks to the tail. So they work in very different ways, but perhaps having both of them is important because they have the same function. So the hypothesis was that a conspicuous tail is important for the deflective effect of stripes. And the prediction was that evolution of stripes is correlated with evolution of a bright tail. Yeah. They do, but there are very few which have stripes that extend right to the tail tip. So if you look at it closely, maybe midway the stripes end and it becomes completely plain. There are a few which have, but in our data set, we have a data set with about 2,000 species. There are very few which have that. But if you take snakes are lizards, as I said. There are a lot of snakes which have stripes running till the tail tip. Right. So how many of you here are familiar with what a phylogeny is and how to interpret? Oh, very good. Then I had prepared to draw out a phylogeny. It seems like it's useful to more than one. So I'm going to talk about a series of analyses which are called comparative phylogenetic analysis. And of course, to start there, I need to talk about what a phylogeny is, right? So here is an example of a phylogeny. You essentially have a branching pattern which encompasses information about relationships among species. But before that, I'm going to take a detour. This is not about lizards. This is in general about phylogenies and how phylogenies are used in evolution. So there's a statement, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. So phylogenetists have a corollary or an addendum. Nothing in evolution makes sense except in the light of phylogeny. Right? So if you look at the species diversity we have now, how did we get all this diversity? It's evolution, and specifically there's an evolutionary process called speciation. Speciation is nothing but one ancestral species diverging into two descendant species. Okay? So very generally we are talking about lineage divergences. So one lineage diverges into two descendant lineages, and so on, right? So this bifurcating pattern is what is called as a phylogeny. It's as simple as that. So a phylogeny depicts this series of lineage divergence events, but ultimately, because you're representing these lineage divergence events, you also get a sense of relationships. So this lineage here is more closely related to this lineage compared to the relationship between this and this, for example, right? So this phylogeny, once you reconstruct a phylogeny, you have a wealth of information. You have so much information which you otherwise would not get. For example, let's take a simple case. This is a genus of plants. Here you have red flowers, and this lineage or this species has yellow flowers. Immediately looking at this phylogeny, you can say that red was ancestral and yellow flowers are derived. So you can get a sense of the direction of evolution. And this reconstruction of these phylogenies, you don't have data for these ancestral lineages. They're all gone. In many cases, we don't even know what this is. It may have been a species, it may have been something else. All we have is information about this. You can collect data. So typically what is done is, these days we only use molecular tools. So we sequence the genome, parts of the genome, use that information to reconstruct the phylogeny. And when you reconstruct a phylogeny using DNA sequences, you have a very useful property. You are able to estimate the times of divergences, okay, in terms of millions of years or thousands of years and so on. So this is done routinely. There are hundreds of researchers who do this routinely. These are well established. There are a lot of tools available to do this. Right. So I'm going to talk about how we use phylogenies to test a couple of hypotheses, really. So the first hypothesis I presented, that the evolution of stripes is correlated with the evolution of conspicuous tail. That is a prediction from our hypothesis. So just as a side note, one can attempt to reconstruct the phylogeny of all of life. So this is one reconstruction. Now we know that there's been a lot of exchange between archaea and bacteria and so on. It's not a strict bifurcating pattern. When you go back so far in time, things get a little more murky. But in most cases, we are able to reconstruct fairly neat bifurcating patterns. Right. So what do we mean when humans evolved from monkeys? Or, you know, some people even loosely say humans evolved from chimpanzees, right? So there was some ancestral primate, there was a lineage divergence event. Here you have the lemurs, lorises, and so on. They split from the rest of the monkeys, then the tarsier split. Then you have the New World monkeys, the ones found in South and North America. They are a distinct group. They diverge. Then the Old World monkeys, a set of monkeys. Then you have the gibbons, orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees are closest to humans, according to this reconstruction. Right. So we evolve, we diverge from the common ancestor of chimpanzee and humans. That's what we mean when we say humans evolved from monkeys. So here you can see there's one attempt to estimate times of divergences. Here you have this scale. All the species that are there now, they all belong to time zero, and you can go back in time. Here is 10 million years. So for example, the New World monkeys split from the other monkeys here about 45 million years ago. Okay, so to test our hypothesis, back to lizards. How am I doing for time? I should be wrapping up soon. Okay, so I'll try to go a little faster. So we, Gopal designed another interactive shell where he downloaded a lot of images online, and these images were given to participants, and they were asked to code whether stripes were present or absent, and the color of the tail, whether it was brightly colored and so on. And we also got information about the snout vent length, which was used for another project I'll talk about. This is the length of the lizards from the tip of the mouth to the snout. This is very commonly used as a measure of body size. So this was the hypothesis. And this is a phylogeny. You have the branching pattern here. This is one part of the phylogeny. This is the actual data. So what you see is that wherever you have stripes, you also tend to have a colorful tail. Okay? So for example, here you only have a colorful tail but no stripes. And well, in this particular case, that's the only aberrant one. But here you have neither. Okay? So this is just one part of the phylogeny, but both stripes and tails have evolved multiple times independently across the phylogeny. But overall, across the phylogeny, so this was a data set with more than 1,500 species. Okay? So it's a large data set. So despite multiple time, despite them having evolved multiple times, we find a strong correlation where whenever you have the evolution of stripes, you also tend to have evolution of conspicuous tail, which again supports our hypothesis, but this time in a different, using a different data set, using a different analytical approach completely.
Based so, on this phylogenetic tree, why do you speculate that they have evolved multiple times?
This is just part of it. As I said, the whole phylogeny, if I presented it, would be a complete mess. This is just one with just a few species, right? So there have been a lot of reversals. You have addition of stripes, you lose stripes and clades and so on. Yeah.
Is there any biochemical connection
between the chromogen of the stripes and the one in the tail? Okay, what we have speculated is that there's some link, either in terms of gene linkages or something in terms of the development, where you have a bias towards both of them being present together, which makes it easy for them to evolve together. No, you can have pigments. I'm not sure there's a structural color. I think this is a pigment. You can have structural colors, which would be completely because of physical structure. No? Okay. Then. No? Okay. So I might be. The butterfly has pigments.
So
butterfly definitely has